Amala 15 bandam canuncari.
Guasco 55.
Where'd they go? Hero says. Everyone's already looking for the float, as though they all noticed at once that it was missing. Finally, they see it, a quarter mile behind them, dead in the water. The bigwigs and the bodyguards are standing up now, all looking in the same direction. The speedboat is circling around to retrieve it. They must have figured out a way to detach the tow cable, Hero says. Not likely, the man with the glass eye says. It was attached to the bottom, under the water. And it's a steel cable, so there's no way they could cut it. Hero sees another small craft bobbing on the water, about halfway between the Russians and the speedboat that was towing them. It's not obvious because it's tiny, close to the water, done up in dull natural colors. It's a one-man kayak, carrying a long-haired man.
Shit, Livio says. Where the hell did he come from?
The kayaker looks behind himself for a few moments, reading the waves, then suddenly turns back around and begins to paddle hard, accelerating, glancing back every few strokes. A big wave is coming, and just as it swells up underneath the kayak, he's matching its speed. The kayak stays on top of the wave and shoots forward like a missile, riding the swell, suddenly going twice as fast as anything else on the water. Digging at the wave with one end of his paddle, the kayaker makes a few crude changes in his direction. Then he parks the paddle athwart the kayak, reaches down inside, and hauls out a small dark object, a tube about 4 feet long, which he hoists up to one shoulder. He and the speedboat shoot past each other going in opposite directions, separated by a gap of only about 20 feet. Then the speedboat blows up. The Kowloon has overshot the site of all this action by a few thousand yards. It's pulling around into as tight a turn as a vessel of the sun, trying to throw a 180 so it can go back and deal with the Russians, and somewhat more problematically, with Raven. Raven is paddling back toward his buddies.
He's such an asshole, Livio says. What's he going to do? Tow them out to the raft behind his fucking kayak?
This gives me the creeps, the man with the glass eye says. Make sure we got some guys up there with stingers. They must have a chopper coming or something.
No other ships on the radar,
says one of the other soldiers, coming in from the bridge.
Just us and them, and no choppers either.
You know Raven carries a nuke, right? Hero says.
So I heard, but that kayak's not big enough. It's tiny. I can't believe you'd go out to sea in something like that.
A mountain is growing out of the sea, a bubble of black water that keeps rising. Well behind the bung raft, a black tower appeared, jutting vertically out of the water, a pair of wings sprouting from its top. The tower keeps getting taller, the wings getting higher out of the water, as before and aft, the mountain rises and shapes itself. Red stars and a few numbers. But no one has to read the numbers to know it's a submarine. A nuclear missile submarine. Then it stops. So close to the Russians on their little raft that Gurov and friends can practically jump onto it. Raven paddles toward them, cutting through the waves like a glass knife.
Fuck me,
the man with the glass eye says. He is utterly astounded.
Fuck me, fuck me, fuck me. Uncle Enzo's gonna be pissed. You couldn't have known, Livio says. Should we shoot at him?
Before the man with the glass eye can make a policy decision, the deck gun on the top of the nuke sub opens up. The first shell misses them by just a few yards.
Okay, we got a rapidly evolving situation. Hero, you come with me.
The crew of the Kowloon has already sized up the situation and placed their bets on the nuclear submarine. They are running up and down the rails, dropping large fiberglass capsules into the water. The capsules break open to reveal bright orange folds, which blossom into life rafts. Once the deck gunners on the nuke sub figure out how to hit the Kowloon, the situation begins to evolve even more rapidly. The Kowloon can't decide whether to sink, burn, or simply disintegrate, so it does all three at once. By that time, most of the people who were on it have made their way onto a life raft. They all bob on the water, zip themselves into orange survival suits, and watch the nuke sub. Raven is the last person to go below decks in the submarine. He spends a minute or two removing some gear from his kayak, a few items in bags, and one 8-foot spear with a translucent, leaf-shaped head. Before he disappears into the hatch, he turns toward the wreckage of the Kowloon and holds the harpoon up over his head, a gesture of triumph and a promise all at once. Then he's gone. A couple of minutes later, the submarine is gone too.
"That guy gives me the creeps," the man with the glass eye says.
Once it starts coming clear to her again that these people are all twisted freaks, she starts to notice other things about them. For example, the whole time, no one ever looks her in the eye, especially the men. No sex at all in these guys. They've got it pushed so far down inside of them. She can understand why they don't look at the fat babushkas, but she's a 15-year-old American chick, and she is used to getting the occasional look. Not here. Until she looks up from her big vat of fish one day and finds that she is looking into some guy's chest. And when she follows his chest upward to his neck, and his neck all the way up to his face, she sees dark eyes staring right back at her, right over the top of the counter. He's got something written on his forehead, "Poor Impulse Control," which is kind of scary. Sexy, too. It gives him a certain measure of romance that none of these other people have. She was expecting the raft to be dark and dangerous, and instead, it's just like working where her mother works. This guy is the first person she's seen around this place who really looks like he belongs on the raft. And he's got the look down, too. Incredibly rank style. Although he has a long, wispy mustache that doesn't do much for his face. Doesn't bring out his features well at all. "Do you take the nasty stuff?" One fishheader, too, she says, dangling the ladle picturesquely. She always talks trash to people because none of them can understand what she's saying.
"I'll take whatever you're offering," the guy says, in English, sort of a crisp accent.
"I'm not offering anything," she says. "But if you want to stand there and browse, that's cool." He stands there and browses for a while, long enough that people farther back in line stand up on tiptoe to see what the problem is. But when they see that the problem is this particular individual, they get down off their toes real fast, hunch down, sort of blend into the mass of fishy-smelling wool.
"What's for dessert today?" the guy asks. "Got anything sweet for me?"
"We don't believe in dessert," YT says. "It's a fucking sin, remember?"
"Depends on your cultural orientation."
"Oh yeah? What culture are you oriented to?"
"I am an Aleut."
"Oh, I've never heard of that."
"That's because we've been fucked over," the big scary Aleut says. "Worse than any other people in history."
"Sorry to hear that," YT says. "So, do you want me to serve up some fish, or are you going to stay hungry?"
The big Aleut stares at her for a while. Then he jerks his head sideways and says, "Come on, let's get the fuck out of here."
"What, and skip out on this cool job?"
He grins ridiculously. "I can find you a better job."
"In this job, do I get to leave my clothes on?"
"Come on, we're going now," he says, those eyes burning into her. She tries to ignore a sudden, warm, tense feeling down between her legs. She starts following him down the cafeteria line, heading for a gap where she can exit into the dining area. The head babushka bitch comes stomping out from in back, hollers at her in some incomprehensible language. YT turns to look back. She feels a pair of big hands sliding up her sides, coming up into her armpits, and she pulls her arms to her sides, trying to stop it. But it's no good. The hands come all the way up and keep lifting, keep rising into the air, bringing her with them.
The big guy hoists her right up over the counter like she's a three-year-old and sets her down next to him. YT turns back around to see the head babushka bitch, but she is frozen in a mixture of surprise, fear, and sexual outrage. But in the end, fear wins out. She averts her eyes, turns away, and goes to replace YT at VAT position number 9. "Thanks for the lift," YT says, her voice wowing and fluttering ridiculously. Didn't you want to eat something?"
"I was thinking of going out anyway," he says.
"Going out? Where do you go out on the raft?"
"Come on. I'll show you."
He leads her down passageways and up steep steel stairways and out onto the deck. It's getting close to twilight. The control tower of the Enterprise looms hard and black against a deep gray sky that's getting dark and gloomy so fast that it seems darker now than it will at midnight. But for now, none of the lights are on, and that's all there is: black steel and slate sky. She follows him down the deck of the ship to the stern. From here, it's a 30-foot drop to the water. They are looking out across the prosperous, clean, white neighborhood of the Russian people, separated from the squalid, dark tangle of the raft, per se, by a wide canal patrolled by gun-toting black robes. There's no stairway or rope ladder here, but there is a thick rope hanging from the railing. The big Aleut guy hauls up a chunk of rope and drapes it under one arm and over one leg in a quick motion. Then he throws one arm around YT's waist, gathering her in the crook of his arm, leans back, and falls off the ship. She absolutely refuses to scream. She feels the rope stop his body, feels his arm squeeze her so tight she chokes for a moment, and then she's hanging there, hanging in the crook of his arm. She's got her arms down to her side, defiant. But just for the hell of it, she leans into him, wraps her arms around his neck, puts her head on his shoulder, and hangs on tight. He rappels them down the rope, and soon they are standing on the sanitized, prosperous Russian version of the raft. "What's your name, anyway?" she says.
"Dmitry Ravanov," he says, "better known as Raven."
"Oh! Shit." The connections between boats are tangled and unpredictable. To get from point A to point B, you have to wander all over the place. But Raven knows where he's going. Occasionally, he reaches out, grabs her hand, but he doesn't yank her around even though she's going a lot slower than he is. Every so often, he looks back at her with a grin like, "I could hurt you, but I won't." They come to a place where the Russian neighborhood is joined to the rest of the raft by a wide plank bridge guarded by Uzi dudes. Raven ignores them, takes YT's hand again, and walks right across the bridge with her. YT hardly has time to think through the implications of this before it hits her. She looks around, sees all these gaunt Asians staring back at her like she's a five-course meal, and realizes, "I'm on the raft." Actually on the raft.
"These are Hong Kong Vietnamese," Raven says. "Started out in Vietnam. Came to Hong Kong as boat people after the war there. So they've been living on sampans for a couple of generations now. Don't be scared. This isn't dangerous for you."
"I don't think I can find my way back here," YT says.
"Relax," he says. "I've never lost a girlfriend."
"Have you ever had a girlfriend?"
Raven throws back his head and laughs. "A lot. In the old days. Not as many in the past few years."
"Oh, yeah? The old days. Is that when you got your tattoo?"
"Yeah. I'm an alcoholic. Used to get in a lot of trouble. Been sober for 8 years.
"Then how come everyone's scared of you?"
Raven turns to her, smiles broadly, shrugs. "Oh, because I'm an incredibly ruthless, efficient, cold-blooded killer. You know."
YT laughs. So does Raven. What's your job? YT asks.
I'm a harpooner, he says.
Like in Moby Dick? YT likes this idea. She read that book in school. Most of the people in her class, even the power tools, thought that the book was totally entrenched. But she liked all the stuff about harpooning.
Nah. Compared to me, those Moby Dicksters were faggots.
What kind of stuff do you harpoon?
You name it.
From there on out, she just looks at him, or at inanimate objects. Because otherwise, she wouldn't see anything except thousands of dark eyes staring back at her. In that way, it's a big change from being a slop-slinger for the repressed. Part of it is just because she's so different. But part of it is that there's no privacy on the raft. You make your way around by hopping from one boat to the next. But each boat is home to about 3 dozen people, so it's like you are constantly walking through people's living rooms and bathrooms and bedrooms. Naturally, they look. They trop across a makeshift platform built on oil drums. A couple of Vietnamese dudes are there arguing or haggling over something. Looks like a slab of fish. The one who's turned toward them sees them coming. His eyes flicker across YT without pausing, fix on Raven, and go wide. He steps back. The guy he's talking to, who has his back to them, turns around and literally jumps into the air, letting out a suppressed grunt. Both of them back well out of Raven's path. And then she figures out something important. These people aren't looking at her. They're not even giving her a second glance. They're all looking at Raven. And it's not just a case of celebrity watching or something like that. All of these raft dudes, these tough, scary homeboys of the sea, are scared shitless of this guy. And she's on a date with him. And it's just started. Suddenly, walking through another Vietnamese living room, YT has a flashback to the most excruciating conversation she ever had, which was a year ago when her mother tried to give her advice on what to do if a boy got fresh with her. Yeah, Mom, right. I'll keep that in mind. Yeah, I'll be sure to remember that. YT knew that advice was worthless. And this goes to show she was right. There are 4 men in the life raft. Hero protagonist, self-employed stringer for the Central Intelligence Corporation, whose practice used to be limited to so-called dry operations, meaning that he sat around and soaked up information and then later spat it back into the library, the CIC database, without ever actually doing anything. Now his practice has become formidably wet. Hero is armed with 2 swords and a 9mm semi-automatic pistol, known colloquially as a 9, with 2 ammunition clips, each carrying 11 rounds. Vic, unspecified last name. If there was still such a thing as income tax, then every year when Vic filled out his 1040 form, he would put down as his occupation, sniper. In classic sniper style, Vic is reticent, unobtrusive. He is armed with a long, large-caliber rifle with a bulky mechanism mounted on its top, where a telescopic sight might be found if Vic were not at the leading edge of his profession. The exact nature of this device is not obvious, but Hero presumes that it is an exquisitely precise sensor package, with fine crosshairs superimposed on the middle. Vic may safely be presumed to be carrying additional small concealed weapons. Elliot Chung. Elliot used to be the skipper of a boat called the Kowloon. At the moment, he is between jobs. Elliot grew up in Watts, and when he speaks English, he sounds like a black guy. Genetically speaking, he is entirely Chinese. He is fluent in both black and white English, as well as Cantonese, Taxilinga, and some Vietnamese, Spanish, and Mandarin. Elliot is armed with a .44 Magnum revolver, which he carried on board the Kowloon just for the halibut, i.e., he used it to execute halibut before passengers hauled them on board. Halibut grow very large and can thrash so violently that they can easily kill the people who hook them. Hence, it is prudent to fire a number of shells through their heads before taking them on board. This is the only reason Elliot carries a weapon. The other defensive needs of the Kowloon were seen to by crew members who were specialists in that kind of thing. Fisheye. This is the man with the glass eye. He will only identify himself by his nickname. He is armed with a large, fat, black suitcase. The suitcase is massively constructed with built-in wheels and weighs somewhere between 300 pounds and a metric ton, as Hero discovers when he tries to move it. Its weight turns the normally flat bottom of the life raft into a puckered cone. The suitcase has a noteworthy attachment. A flexible 3-inch thick cable or hose or something, a couple of meters long, that emerges from one corner, runs up the sloping floor of the life raft, over the edge, and trails in the water. At the end of this mysterious tentacle is a hunk of metal about the size of a wastebasket, but so finely sculpted into so many narrow fins and veins that it appears to have a surface area the size of Delaware. Hero only saw this thing out of the water for a few chaotic moments when it was being transferred into the life raft. At that time, it was glowing red hot. Since then, it has lurked below the surface, light gray, impossible to see clearly because the water around it is forever churning in a full rolling boil. Fist-sized bubbles of steam coalesce amid its fractal tracery of hot veins and pummel the surface of the ocean ceaselessly, all day and all night. The powerless life raft, sloshing around the North Pacific, emits a vast, spreading plume of steam, like that of an iron horse chugging full blast over the continental divide. Neither Hero nor Elliot ever mentions or even notices the by now obvious fact that Fisheye is traveling with a small, self-contained nuclear power source, almost certainly radiothermal isotopes, like the ones that power the rat thing. As long as Fisheye refuses to notice this fact, it would be rude for them to bring it up. All of the participants are clad in bright orange padded suits that cover their entire bodies. They are the North Pacific version of life vests. They are bulky and awkward, but Elliot Chung likes to say that in northern waters, the only thing a life vest does is make your corpse float. The lifeboat is an inflatable raft about 10 feet long that does not come equipped with a motor. It has a tent-like, waterproof canopy that they can zip up all the way around, turning it into a sealed capsule so that the water stays out even the most violent weather. For a couple of days, a powerful chill wind coming down out off the mountains drives them out of Oregon, out toward the open water. Elliot explains, cheerfully, that this lifeboat was invented back in the old days, when they had navies and coast guards that would come and rescue stranded travelers. All you had to do was float and be orange. Fisheye has a walkie-talkie, but it is a short-range device. And Hero's computer is capable of jacking into the net, but in this regard, it functions much like a cellular telephone. It doesn't work out in the middle of nowhere. When the weather is extremely rainy, they sit under the canopy. When it's less rainy, they sit above it. They all have ways of passing the time. Hero dicks around with his computer, naturally. Being stranded on a life raft in the Pacific is a perfect venue for a hacker. Vic reads and rereads a soaked paperback novel that he had in the pocket of his windbreaker when the Kowloon got blown out from under them. These days of waiting are much easier for him. As a professional sniper, he knows how to kill time. Elliot looks at things with his binoculars, even though there is very little to look at. He spends a lot of time messing around with the raft, fretting about it in the way that boat captains do. And he does a lot of fishing. They have plenty of stored food on the raft, but the occasional fresh halibut and salmon are nice to eat. Fisheye has taken what appears to be an instruction manual from the heavy black suitcase. It is a miniature three-ring binder with pages of laser-printed text. The binder is just a cheap, unmarked one bought from a stationery store. In these respects, it is perfectly familiar to Hero. It bears the earmarks of a high-tech product that is still under development. All technical devices require documentation of a sort, but this stuff can only be written by the techies who are doing the actual product development, and they absolutely hate it, always put the docs question off to the very last minute. Then they type up some material on a word processor, run it off on the laser printer, send the departmental secretary out for a cheap binder, and that's that. But this only occupies Fisheye for a little while. He spends the rest of the time just staring off at the horizon, as though he's expecting Sicily to heave into view. It doesn't. He is despondent over the failure of his mission, and spends a lot of time mumbling under his breath, trying to find a way to salvage it.
"If you don't mind my asking," Hero says, "what was your mission anyway?"
Fisheye thinks this one over for a while.
"Well, it depends on how you look at it. Nominally, my objective is to get a 15-year-old girl back from these assholes. So my tactic was to take a bunch of their bigwigs hostage, then arrange a trade. Who's this 15-year-old girl?"
Fisheye shrugs.
"You know her. It's YT. Is that really your whole objective?" "The important thing is, Hero, that you have to understand the Mafia way. And the Mafia way is that we pursue larger goals under the guise of personal relationships. So, for example, when you were a pizza guy, you didn't deliver pizzas fast because you made more money that way or because it was some kind of a fucking policy. You did it because you were carrying out a personal covenant between Uncle Enzo and every customer. This is how we avoid the trap of self-perpetuating ideology. Ideology is a virus. So getting this chick back is more than just getting a chick back. It's the concrete manifestation of an abstract policy goal. And we like concrete. Right, Vic?"
Vic allows himself a judicious sneer and a deep grinding laugh.
"What's the abstract policy goal in this case?" Hero says. "Not my department," Fisheye says. "But I think Uncle Enzo is real pissed at L. Bob Reif."
Hero is messing around in Flatland. He is doing this partly to conserve the computer's batteries. Rendering a three-dimensional office takes a lot of processors working full-time, while a simple two-dimensional desktop display requires minimal power. But his real reason for being in Flatland is that Hero Protagonist, last of the freelance hackers, is hacking. And when hackers are hacking, they don't mess around with the superficial world of metaverses and avatars. They descend below this surface layer and into the netherworld of code and tangled namshubs that supports it, where everything that you see in the metaverse, no matter how lifelike and beautiful and three-dimensional, reduces to a simple text file, a series of letters on an electronic page. It is a throwback to the days when people programmed computers through primitive teletypes and IBM punch cards. Since then, pretty and user-friendly programming tools have been developed. It's possible to program a computer now by sitting at your desk in the metaverse and manually connecting little pre-programmed units like Tinker Toys. But a real hacker would never use such techniques, any more than a master auto mechanic would try to fix a car by sliding in behind the steering wheel and watching the idiot lights on the dashboard. Hero does not know what he is doing, what he is preparing for. That's okay, though. Most of programming is a matter of laying groundwork, building structures of words that seem to have no particular connection to the task at hand. He knows one thing. The metaverse has now become a place where you can get killed. Or at least, have your brain reamed out to the point where you might as well be dead. This is a radical change in the nature of the place. Guns have come to paradise. It serves them right, he realizes now. They made the place too vulnerable. They figured that the worst thing that could happen was that a virus might get transferred into your computer and force you to ungoggle and reboot your system. Maybe destroy a little data if you were stupid enough not to install any medicine. Therefore, the metaverse is wide open and undefended, like airports in the days before bombs and metal detectors, like elementary schools in the days before maniacs with assault rifles. Anyone can go in and do anything they want to. There are no cops. You can't defend yourself. You can't chase the bad people. It's going to take a lot of work to change that. A fundamental rebuilding of the whole metaverse, carried out on a planet-wide corporate level. In the meantime, there may be a role for individuals who know their way around the place. A few hacks can make a lot of difference in this situation. A freelance hacker could get a lot of shit done, years before the giant software factories bestir themselves to deal with the problem. The virus that ate through David's brain was a string of binary information shown into his face in the form of a bitmap. A series of white and black pixels, where white represents zero and black represents one. They put the bitmap onto scrolls and gave the scrolls to avatars who went around the metaverse looking for victims. The Clint who tried to infect Hero in the Black Sun got away, but he left his scroll behind. He didn't reckon on having his arms lopped off, and Hero dumped it into the tunnel system below the floor, the place where the graveyard demons live. Later, Hero had a demon take the scroll back to his workshop. And anything that is in Hero's house is, by definition, stored inside his own computer. He doesn't have to jack into the global network in order to access it. It's not easy working with a piece of data that can kill you, but that's okay. In reality, people work with dangerous substances all the time. Radioactive isotopes and toxic chemicals. You just have to have the right tools. Remote manipulator arms, gloves, goggles, leaded glass. And in Flatland, when you need a tool, you just sit down and write it. So Hero starts by writing a few simple programs that enable him to manipulate the contents of the scroll without ever seeing it. The scroll, like any other visible thing in the metaverse, is a piece of software. It contains some code that describes what it looks like, so that your computer will know how to draw it, and some routines that govern the way it rolls and unrolls. And it contains somewhere inside of itself a resource, a hunk of data, the digital version of the snow crash virus. Once the virus has been extracted and isolated, it is easy enough for Hero to write a new program called Snow Scan. Snow Scan is a piece of medicine. That is, it is code that protects Hero's system, both his hardware and, as Lagos would put it, his bioware, from the digital snow crash virus. Once Hero has installed it in his system, it will constantly scan the information coming in from outside, looking for data that matches the contents of the scroll. If it notices such information, it will block it. There's other work to do in Flatland. Hero's good with avatars, so he writes himself an invisible avatar, just because, in the new and more dangerous metaverse, it might come in handy. This is easy to do poorly and surprisingly tricky to do well. Almost anyone can write an avatar that doesn't look like anything, but it will lead to a lot of problems when it is used. Some metaverse real estate, including the Black Sun, wants to know how big your avatar is so that it can figure out whether you are colliding with another avatar or some obstacle. If you give it an answer of zero, you make your avatar infinitely small. You will either crash that piece of real estate or else make it think that something is very wrong. You will be invisible, but everywhere you go in the metaverse, you will leave a swath of destruction and confusion a mile wide. In other places, invisible avatars are illegal. If your avatar is transparent and reflects no light whatsoever, the easiest kind to write, it will be recognized instantly as an illegal avatar and alarms will go off. It has to be written in such a way that other people can't see it, but the real estate software doesn't realize that it's invisible. There are about 100 little tricks like this that Hero wouldn't know about if he hadn't been programming avatars for people like Vitaly Chernobyl for the last couple of years. To write a really good invisible avatar from scratch would take a long time, but he puts one together in several hours by recycling bits and pieces of old projects left behind in his computer, which is how hackers usually do it. While he's doing that, he comes across a rather old folder with some transportation software in it. This is left over from the very old days of the metaverse, before the monorail existed, when the only way to get around was to walk or to ride a piece of ware that simulated a vehicle. In the early days, when the metaverse was a featureless black ball, this was a trivial job. Later on, when the street went up and people started building real estate, it became more complicated. On the street, you can pass through other people's avatars, but you can't pass through walls. You can't enter private property, and you can't pass through other vehicles or through permanent street fixtures, such as the ports and the stanchions that support the monorail line. If you try to collide with any of these things, you don't die or get kicked out of the metaverse. You just come to a complete stop, like a cartoon character running spang into a concrete wall. In other words, once the metaverse began to fill up with obstacles that you can run into, the job of traveling across it at high speed suddenly became more interesting. Maneuverability became an issue. Size became an issue. Hero and David and the rest of them began to switch away from the enormous bizarre vehicles they had favored at first. Victorian houses on tank treads, rolling ocean liners, mile-wide crystalline spheres, flaming chariots drawn by dragons, in favor of small maneuverable vehicles. Motorcycles, basically. A metaverse vehicle can be as fast and nimble as a quark. There's no physics to worry about, no constraints on acceleration, no air resistance. Tires never squeal and brakes never lock up. The one thing that can't be helped is the reaction time of the user. So when they were racing their latest motorcycle software, holding wild rallies through downtown at Mach 1, they didn't worry about engine capacity. They worried about the user interface, the controls that enabled the rider to transfer his reactions into the machine, to steer, accelerate, or brake as quickly as he could think. Because when you're in a pack of bike racers going through a crowded area at that speed, and you run into something and suddenly slow down to a speed of exactly zero, you can forget about catching up. One mistake, and you've lost. Hero had a pretty good motorcycle. He probably could have had the best one on the street simply because his reflexes are unearthly. But he was more preoccupied with sword fighting than motorcycle riding. He opens up the most recent version of his motorcycle software, gets familiar with the controls again. He ascends from Flatland into the three-dimensional metaverse and practices riding his bike around his yard for a while. Beyond the boundaries of his yard is nothing but blackness, because he's not jacked into the net. It is a lost, desolate sensation, kind of like floating on a life raft in the Pacific Ocean.